This he did, as always. He heard the word lunch and backed away. Hal Greenwood opened the door and reported that the jurors were hungry. Walter explained that he was a step ahead and sandwiches had been ordered. As they waited, Hal suggested they take an initial vote on the issue of guilt. In no particular order, each of the 12 said the word guilty, though a couple were more reluctant than others. John and Russell Wilbanks had lunch in the firm's conference room. They usually walked down the street to a cafe, but were not in the mood for the stares and banal observations from the people they saw almost every day. Russell admired his brother's last appeal to the jury and was convinced one or two would hold out for a life sentence. John was not as confident. He was still frustrated, even moody and depressed, over how he had handled the trial. If given free rein, he could have mounted a strong insanity defense and saved Pete's life. His client, though, seemed hell-bent on destruction. In perhaps the biggest case of his career, he had been boxed in and relegated to being little more than a bystander. As he toyed with his lunch, he reminded himself that nothing in a trial lawyer's life was as nerve-wracking as waiting on a jury. One of Joel's fraternity brothers was from a small town an hour from the Vanderbilt campus. When the trial began Monday morning, Joel found it impossible to think of anything else. His friend invited him to the family's estate, where they rode horses, hunted for hours deep in the woods, and tried to talk of anything but what was happening in Clanton. He called Stella each evening to check on her. She, too, was skipping classes and trying to avoid people. Russell Wilbanks was correct. 3 of the 12 could not bring themselves to vote in favor of death, at least not in the early deliberations. 1, Wilbur Stack, was a veteran of the war who had been wounded 3 times in Italy. He had survived Miles Truitt's peremptory challenges simply because Miles used all 5 before he could exempt Stack. Another, Dale Musgrave, ran a sawmill down by the lake and admitted that his father had done business with Pete's father and had often expressed great admiration for the family. It was pointed out that perhaps this should have been mentioned during the selection process, but it was too late. The 3rd, Vince Pendergrass, was a Pentecostal house painter who claimed no ties to the Bannings, but found it difficult to believe that he was expected to kill a man. Several of the other 9 expressed the same feelings, but were also determined to follow the law. None of the 12 were eager to vote for death, but all believed in the death penalty. On paper and in theory, it was quite popular throughout the country and certainly in Mississippi. But very few people served on juries where they were asked to pull the switch. That was an altogether different matter. The debate went on in a dignified manner, with each man given ample opportunity to express his views. The snow was gone. The skies were clear, the roads passable. There was no urgency in getting home. At 3 p.m., Hal Greenwood opened the door and asked Walter for a pot of coffee and 12 cups. After the coffee, and with the room fogged with cigarette smoke, decorum began to unravel as voices rose. The dividing line was clear, but not entrenched. The 9 never wavered, but the 3 showed signs of capitulation. It was pointed out repeatedly that they were dealing with a murder that was well planned and should have been avoided. If Pete Banning had only taken the stand and explained his motives, then there might be some sympathy. But he just sat there, seemingly oblivious to his own trial, and never once looked at the jurors. The man was obviously damaged by the war. Why didn't his lawyer prove this? Could his motive have something to do with his wife and Dexter Bell? The Methodists resented this suggestion and defended the honor of the slain pastor. Hal Greenwood cautioned them that it was not their place to weigh the case outside the facts. They were bound by what they heard and saw in the courtroom. Around 4, Vince Pendergrass changed his mind and sided with the majority. It was the first conversion and a pivotal moment. The 10 felt emboldened and ratcheted up the pressure on Wilbur Stack and Dale Musgrave. Ernie Dowdle entered the hallway from the courtroom and caught Walter Willey dozing by the door to the jury room. It was almost 5, past time for Ernie to go home, and he stopped by to ask Walter if he needed anything. Walter assured him he did not and told him to move along. He had matters firmly under control.
"What they doing in there?"
Ernie asked, nodding at the door.
"Deliberating," Walter said professionally. "Now please, leave."
"Gonna get a verdict?"
"I can't say."
Ernie left and climbed a narrow stairway to the 3rd floor, where the county kept a small law library and some storage rooms. Walking as softly as possible, he opened the door to a dark and narrow utility room where Penrod was sitting on a stool with an unlit corncob pipe in his mouth. A cast iron air vent ran from the floor to the ceiling. A slit in the floor beside it carried not only the smell of cigarette smoke, but the muted voices of the jurors directly below. With hardly a sound, Penrod said,
11-1.
Ernie looked surprised. An hour earlier, the vote had been 9-3. He and Penrod were certain they would be fired and probably jailed if anyone learned of their eavesdropping, so they kept it to themselves. Most cases involving juries were civil in nature and too boring to fool with. The occasional criminal trial usually involved a black defendant and an all-white jury with deliberations that were quick and predictable. Mr. Banning's trial was far more interesting. Were the white folks really going to convict and kill one of their own? Having accomplished nothing through the afternoon, John Wilbanks decided to settle his nerves as darkness approached. He and Russell retired to an upstairs room where they kept a coffee pot and a fully stocked bar. Russell poured them Jack Daniels over ice, and they sat in old straw chairs that had been in the firm for decades. Through a window, they could see the courthouse across the street, and on the 2nd floor, they could see silhouettes of the jurors as they occasionally moved around the room. They had had the case for over 6 hours, which was not a long time in rural Mississippi. John recalled the old story of a Depression-era jury that hung up for days over a trivial dispute. When the verdict was finally given and the jurors dismissed, the truth came out. $1 a day was pretty good money back then, and most of the jurors had little else to do. They shared a laugh, poured another shot, and were discussing the possibilities of dinner when the light in the jury room went out. Moments later, the office phone rang. A secretary walked upstairs with the news that the jury was ready. Judge Oswalt allowed some time to pass so the word could spread and the crowd could reconvene. At 7 p.m., as promised, he appeared on the bench in a black robe, told Walter Willey to dispense with his yodeling, and ordered Nix to bring in the defendant. Pete Banning walked to his chair and sat down without looking at a soul. When everyone was in place, Walter fetched the jury. They filed in slowly, one by one, with each face downcast. One glanced at the audience, another glanced at Pete. They sat down and looked at the bench, as if hating the moment and wanting desperately to be somewhere else. Judge Oswalt said,
"Gentlemen of the jury, have you reached a verdict?"
Hal Greenwood stood with a sheet of paper.
"Yes, Your Honor, we have.
Please hand it to the bailiff."
Walter Willey took the sheet of paper from Hal and, without looking at it, took it to the bench and gave it to the judge, who read it slowly and asked,
"Gentlemen, do each of you agree with this verdict?"
All 12 nodded, some barely, none with enthusiasm.
"Would the defendant please stand?"
Pete Banning slowly stood, straightened his back, braced his shoulders, raised his chin, and glared at Judge Oswalt.
"The unanimous verdict is as follows. We, the jury, find the defendant Pete Banning guilty of first-degree murder in the death of Dexter Bell. And we, the jury, order a sentence of death by electrocution."
Not only did the defendant fail to flinch, he didn't even blink. Others did, though. And throughout the crowd, there were a few gasps and groans. And in the jury box, Wilbur Stack was suddenly overcome with emotion and covered his face with his hands. For the rest of his life, he would regret the day he caved and voted to kill another soldier. Flory kept it together, primarily because the verdict was no surprise. Her brother expected this outcome. She had watched the jurors through every word of the trial and knew there would be no compassion. And frankly, why should there be? For reasons that seemed unfathomable, her brother had turned into a killer, one who wanted no sympathy. She touched a tissue to her cheeks and thought about Joel and Stella, but managed to keep her composure. She could lose it later when she was alone. Judge Oswalt picked up another sheet of paper and read,
"Mr. Banning, by virtue of the power granted unto me by the state of Mississippi, I hereby sentence you to death by electrocution 90 days from today, April 8th. You may sit down."
Pete took his seat with no expression. Judge Oswalt informed the lawyers they would have 30 days to file post-trial motions and appeals. Then he thanked the jurors for their service and excused them. When they were gone, he pointed at Pete, looked at Nix, and said,
"Take him back to the jail."
Chapter 17. At the tea shop on the square, the doors opened as usual at 6 a.m., and within minutes the place was full as lawyers, bankers, ministers, and businessmen, the white-collar crowd, gathered over coffee and biscuits and passed around the morning newspapers. No one ate alone. There was a round table for Democrats and another across the room for Republicans. The Ole Miss diehards huddled together in a clique near the front, while those who favored the state college preferred a table near the kitchen. The Methodists had a spot, the Baptists another. Intertable discussions were common, as were jokes and gags, but real arguments were rare. The verdict attracted a full house. Everyone knew the facts and details and even the gossip, but they came early anyway to make sure they had missed nothing. Perhaps Pete Banning had broken his silence and said something to his lawyer or Nix Gridley. Perhaps Jackie Bell had commented on the verdict to a reporter. Perhaps the Tupelo paper had sniffed out a lead the others had missed. And the biggest topic to discuss, would the state really execute Pete Banning? A contractor asked Reed Taylor, a lawyer, about the appeals process. Reed explained that John Wilbanks had 30 days to notify the court that he would appeal, then 30 more to file his briefs and the necessary paperwork. The attorney general in Jackson would handle the briefs for the state, and his office would have 30 more days to answer whatever John Wilbanks filed. That's 90 days. The state Supreme Court would then consider the case, and that would take a few months. If the court reversed the conviction, and Reed frankly saw no possible way that would happen, the case would be sent back to Ford County for a retrial. If the Supreme Court affirmed the conviction, John Wilbanks could stall things and attempt to appeal further to the U.S. Supreme Court. That would be a waste of time, but it might buy Pete a few months. If Wilbanks chose not to do this, then the execution could take place within the calendar year. Reed went on to explain that in a death case, the appeal was automatic. He had watched the entire trial and had seen no error upon which to base an appeal, but one had to be filed regardless. Furthermore, as Reed went on, the only possible mistake in the trial was allowing that soldier to testify about the war, and of course, that was prejudicial to the prosecution. It gave John Wilbanks nothing to argue on appeal. After Reed finished, the men went back into their huddles and the conversations were muted. Occasionally, the door opened and a welcome blast of cold air penetrated the fog of cigarette smoke and bacon grease. Their state senator arrived, seeking votes. He was not one of them, but instead lived in Smithfield, down in Polk County. They saw little of him until re-election time, and most of them quietly resented his presence in town during its moment of high drama. He made the rounds with a sappy smile, collecting handshakes and trying to remember names. He finally found a chair with the Baptists, all of whom were busy reading newspapers and sipping coffee. He had once waffled on the issue of statewide alcohol, and they had no use for him. As the early morning dragged on, it became apparent that there was nothing new in the Banning case. The trial had been quick, the verdict quicker. Evidently, after it was rendered, nothing important had been said by the jurors, the lawyers, the defendant, or the victim's family. Efforts around the tea shop to create rumors fell flat, and by 7:30, the men were queuing up at the cash register. Late Wednesday night, after the dreaded phone call from Aunt Florrie, Joel returned to campus. Early Thursday, he went to the periodicals section of the main campus library, where there were racks of a dozen morning editions from around the country. Tupelo and Jackson were not included, but the Memphis Press-Cimeter was always there. He took it to a booth and hid, staring at the photo of his father as he left the courthouse in handcuffs, and reading accounts of what happened when the jury returned with its verdict. He still couldn't believe an execution date had been set so soon. He couldn't believe any of this tragedy. His graduation was on for May 17th. So, about 5 weeks or so after his father was to be strapped into an electric chair, he, young Joel Banning, aged 21, was expected to march proudly across the lawn in cap and gown, with 1,000 others, and get his degree from a prestigious university. It seemed impossible. Attending another class seemed impossible, too. While his fraternity brothers had closed ranks and were trying their best to protect him and maintain some semblance of a normal college life, Joel felt stigmatized, ashamed, at times even embarrassed. He felt the stares in class. He could almost hear the whispers, on campus and off. He was a senior with good grades and could coast to graduation, which was exactly what he planned to do. He would meet with his professors and make promises. Quitting was not an option. Surviving was the challenge. His application to the law school at Yale had been rejected. He was in at Vanderbilt and Ole Miss, and the difference in cost was substantial. Now that his father had been convicted of the murder, a wrongful death lawsuit could be expected. The family's finances were in for uncertain times, and Joel wasn't sure law school was feasible. Imagine, a Banning worried about money, and all because his father carried a grudge. Whatever the conflict between Pete and Reverend Bell, it wasn't worth the damage. An hour passed, and Joel skipped his first class. He left the library, wandered across campus, and bought a cup of coffee in the cafeteria. He drank it, skipped his second class, then returned to his dorm and called his sister. Stella was drifting too. She had decided to take a leave and go hide in D.C. for the rest of the year. She loved Hollins and would one day graduate, but at the moment every face she saw belonged to someone who knew her father was in jail for murder and now condemned to die. The shame and pity were too much. She ached for her mother's embrace. She grieved for her father, but she was also finding it easier to think ill of him. Her favorite dean knew a Hollins graduate in D.C. and made the call. Stella would leave on the next train, live in a small guest cottage in Georgetown, babysit some kids, tutor them, be a nanny, a gopher, or whatever. And outside her host family, no one she encountered would know her name or where she was from. The move from Roanoke to Washington would put even more miles between her and Clanton. Working for the Memphis Press-Semeter, a Cub reporter named Hardy Capley covered the trial from start to finish. His brother had been a POW during the war, and Hardy was intrigued by the presence of Clay Wampler, the Colorado cowboy who had served with Pete Banning in the Philippines. Clay was not allowed to testify, but had made his presence known around the courtroom, especially during the recesses. He hung around Clanton for a few days after the trial and eventually left. Hardy badgered his editor until he relented and allowed the reporter to pursue the story. Hardy traveled by bus and train to Colorado and spent 2 days with Wampler, who spoke freely of his adventures and escapades fighting the Japanese as a guerrilla under the command of Pete Banning. Hardy's story was 10,000 words and could have been five times that. It was an incredible narrative that deserved to be published, but it was simply too long for a newspaper. He refused to cut it, threatened to quit and take it elsewhere, and harangued his bosses at the newspaper until they agreed to publish it in a three-part series. In remarkable detail, Hardy described the siege of Bataan, the bravery of the American and Filipino troops, their disease, starvation, and fear, their incredible courage in the face of a superior force, and their humiliation in being forced to surrender. The now infamous Bataan Death March was narrated so vividly that the editors were forced to tone it down somewhat. The savagery and cruelty of the Japanese soldiers was described with minor editing. The wanton murder and neglect of so many American POWs was heartbreaking and infuriating. Though much of the story had already been told, both by escapees and by survivors, the story hit hard in Clanton because it involved one of their own. For over 2 years, Pete Banning had led a ragtag group of American and Filipino commandos as they harassed the Japanese, certain every morning that the day would be their last. Having avoided death so many times, they accepted it as a fact and fought with reckless abandon. They killed hundreds of Japanese soldiers. They destroyed bridges, railroads, airplanes, barracks, tanks, armories, and supply stations. They became so feared that a bounty of $10,000 was placed on the head of Pete Banning. Constantly pursued, the guerrillas could disappear into the jungles and attack days later, 20 miles away, from their last known position. In Wampler's biased opinion, Pete Banning was the greatest soldier he had ever known. The series was widely read in Ford County and throttled most of the enthusiasm to see Pete executed. Judge Oswalt even commented to John Wilbanks that had the newspaper published the stories before the trial, he would have been forced to move it 100 miles away. Pete Banning had steadfastly refused to talk about the war. Now someone else was doing the talking, and many in the county wanted a different ending to his story. If the defendant was burdened by his conviction and death sentence, he showed no signs of it. Pete went about his duties as trustee as if the trial had never taken place. He kept the jail on a strict schedule, kept the two prisoner restrooms clean and orderly, barked at inmates who did not make their beds each morning or left trash on the floors of their cells, encouraged them to read books, newspapers, and magazines, and was teaching two of the inmates, one white and the other black, how to read. He maintained a steady supply of good food, primarily from his farm. When he wasn't busy puttering around the jail, he played cribbage for hours with Leon Colliver, read stacks of novels, and napped. Not once did he complain about his trial or mention his fate. His mail increased dramatically after the trial. The letters came from almost every state, and they were written by other veterans who had survived the horrors of war in the Philippines. Long letters in which the soldiers told their stories. They supported Pete and found it appalling that such a hero was about to be executed. He wrote them back, short notes because of the volume, and before long, he was spending 2 hours a day with his correspondents. His letters to his children grew longer. He would soon be gone, but his written words would be theirs forever. Joel did not admit he was having second thoughts about law school. Stella certainly did not admit she was living in D.C. with her studies suspended. Her dean at Hollins forwarded Pete's letters and in return mailed Stella's to him. She had not even told Florrie where she was. Pete was in the middle of a cribbage game one afternoon when Tick Poley interrupted and said his lawyer was there. Pete said thanks, then played on, making John Wilbanks wait 20 minutes until the game was over. When they were alone in the sheriff's office, Wilbanks said, "We have to file your appeal by next Wednesday." "What appeal?" Pete asked. "Good question. It's really not an appeal because we have nothing to appeal. However, the law says that in a death case, the appeal is automatic, so I have to file something." "That makes no sense. Like a lot of the law," Pete said. He opened a pack of Pall Mells and lit one. "Well, Pete, I didn't make the law, but rules are rules. I'm going to file a very thin brief and get it in under the wire. You want to read it?"
"What's it going to say? What are my grounds for an appeal?"
"Not much. I'm sure I'll use the old standby. The verdict was against the overwhelming weight of the evidence."
"I thought the evidence sounded pretty good."
"Indeed it did. And since I was precluded from mounting a defense on the grounds of insanity, which was our only possible strategy, and one that would have worked beautifully, then there really isn't much to write about."
"I'm not crazy, John."
"We've had this discussion, and it's too late to cover it again."
"I don't like the idea of an appeal."
"Why am I not surprised?"
"I've been sentenced by a jury of my peers, good men from my home county, and they have more sense than those judges down in Jackson. Let's leave their verdict alone, John."
"I have to file something. It's automatic."
"Do not file an appeal on my behalf. Do you understand me, John?"
"I have no choice."
"Then I'll find another lawyer.
Oh, great, Pete. This is just beautiful. You want to fire me now that the trial is over? You want another lawyer so you can handcuff him, too? You're headed for the electric chair, Pete. Who in hell would want to represent you this late in the fourth quarter?
Do not file an appeal for me.
John Wilbanks bolted to his feet and headed for the door.
I'll file it because it has to be filed. But I'm not wasting any more time, Pete. You haven't paid my fee for the trial.
I'll get around to it.
That's what you keep saying.
Wilbanks opened the door, marched through, and slammed it behind him. The appeal was filed, and John Wilbanks, to his knowledge, was not fired. Nor was he paid. It was one of the thinnest filings ever received by the Mississippi Supreme Court in a murder case, and in response, the state answered fully, which was to say, with another thin brief. There was simply nothing wrong with the trial, and the defendant claimed no prejudicial errors. For a court often criticized for its glacier-like pace, the justices were reluctant to affirm so quickly in such a notorious case. Instead, they instructed their clerk to reshuffle the docket and set the Banning matter for oral argument for later in the spring. John Wilbanks informed the clerk that he had not requested oral argument and would not participate in one. He had nothing to argue. April 8th came and went with no execution. By then, word had filtered through the tea shop that delays were in the works and no firm date had been set, so the town was not counting the days. Instead, as spring arrived, the gossip around the town and county ventured away from Pete Banning and turned to the most important aspect of life, the planting of cotton. The fields were plowed and tilled and prepped for the seed, and the weather was watched intently. The farmers studied the skies as they marked their calendars. Plant too early, say in late March, and heavy rains could wash away the seed. Plant too late, say by the 1st of May, and the crop would be off to a bad start and run the risk of being flooded come October. Farming, as always, was an annual crapshoot. Buford Provine, the Bannings' longtime foreman, began stopping by the jail each morning for a cigarette with Pete. They usually met outdoors behind the jail, with Buford leaning against a tree, while Pete stretched his legs on the other side of the 8-foot chain-link fence. He was in the yard, a small square dirt patch sometimes used by the inmates for fresh air. It was also used for visitation and conferences with lawyers. Anything to get outside the jail. On April 9th, the day after he was supposed to die, Pete and Buford discussed the almanacs and forecasts from the weather service and made the decision to plant the seeds as soon as possible. As Buford drove away from the jail, Pete watched his truck disappear. He was pleased with their decision to plant, but he also knew that he would not be around for the harvest. The day before he was to graduate from Vanderbilt, Joel packed his possessions into two duffel bags and left Nashville. He took the train to D.C. and found Stella in Georgetown. She was delighted to see him and claimed to be quite happy with her job, that of practically raising three children. Her guest cottage was too small for another boarder, and besides, her boss did not want anyone else living there. Joel found a room in a flophouse near DuPont Circle and got a job as a waiter in an upscale restaurant. He and Stella explored the city as much as her job would allow, and they reveled in being around large numbers of people who had no idea where they were from. In long letters home, they explained to Aunt Florrie and to their father that they had summer jobs in D.C. and life was okay. More about classes later. On June 4th, the Mississippi Supreme Court, without oral argument, unanimously affirmed the conviction and sentence of Pete Banning and remanded the case back to Judge Oswalt. A week later, he set the execution 30 days away, on Thursday, July 10th. There were no more appeals. Chapter 18. Prior to 1940, Mississippi executed its criminals by hanging, which at the time was the preferred method throughout the country. In some states, the killings were done quietly with little fanfare, but in others, they were public events. Tough politicians in Mississippi firmly believed that showing the people what could happen if they stepped too far out of line was an effective means of controlling crime. So capital punishment became a show in most instances. Local sheriffs made the decisions, and as a general rule, white defendants were hanged in private, while black ones were put on display. Between 1818 and 1940, the state hanged 800 people, 80% of whom were black. Those, of course, were the judicial hangings for rapists and murderers who had been processed through the courts. During that same period of time, approximately 600 black men were lynched by mobs operating outside the legal system and thoroughly immune from any of its repercussions. The state prison was named after its first warden, Jim Parchman. It was a large cotton plantation covering 8,000 acres in Sunflower County, in the heart of the Delta. The people there did not want their home to be known as the Death County, and they had politicians with clout. As a result, hangings took place in the counties where the crimes were committed. There were no fixed gallows, no trained executioners, no standard procedures, no protocol. It wasn't that complicated. Just secure a rope around a man's neck and watch him drop. The locals built the frames, crossbeams, and trap doors, and the sheriffs were in charge of stringing up the condemned as the crowds looked on. Hanging was quick and efficient, but there were problems. In 1932, a white man named Guy Fairley was hanged, but something went wrong. His neck didn't break as planned, and he flailed about, choking, bleeding, screaming, and taking much too long to die. His death was widely reported and prompted talk of reform. In 1937, a white man named Trey Sampson dropped through the trap door and died instantly when his head snapped completely off and rolled toward the sheriff. A photographer was there, and though no newspaper would run the photo, it made the rounds anyway. In 1940, the state legislature addressed the problem. A compromise was reached when it was agreed that the state would stop hanging and move to the more modern method of electrocution. And since there was too much opposition to killing the defendants at Parchman, the state decided to construct a portable electric chair that could easily be moved from county to county. Impressed with their ingenuity, the legislators quickly passed this into law. Some problems arose when it was realized that no one in the country had ever used a portable electric chair. And for a while anyway, no reputable electrical contractor wanted to touch this unique and clever idea. Finally, a company in Memphis stepped forward and designed the first portable electric chair in history. It came with 600 feet of high-tension cables, a switchboard, its own generator, helmet straps, and electrodes designed from specs borrowed from states with stationary electric chairs. The entire unit was carried from county to county in a large silver truck, specially designed for such occasions. The new state executioner was a sleazy character named Jimmy Thompson, who had just been paroled from Parchman, where he had served time for armed robbery. In addition to being an ex-con, He was an ex-sailor, ex-marine, ex-carnival showboat, ex-hypnotist, and frequent drunkard. He got the job through political patronage. He personally knew the governor. He was paid $100 per execution plus expenses. Thompson loved cameras and was always available for interviews. He arrived early to each site, displayed his portable chair and its switchboard, and posed for photos with the locals. After his first execution, he told a newspaper the defendant died with tears in his eyes for the efficient care I took to give him a good clean burning. The deceased, a black man named Willie Mae Bragg, who had been convicted of killing his wife, was photographed being strapped in by deputies and then dying from electrocution. The executions were not open to the public, but there were always plenty of witnesses. The chair was soon nicknamed Old Sparky, and its fame grew. In a rare moment, Mississippi was on the progressive end of something. Louisiana noticed it and built a copycat version, though no other states followed suit. From October of 1940 to January of 1947, Old Sparky was used 37 times as Jimmy Thompson toured the state with his roadshow. Practice did not make perfect, and though the citizens were quite proud of the killings, complaints arose. No two executions were the same. Some were quick and seemingly merciful. Others, though, were drawn out and dreadful. In 1943, an electrocution in Lee County went awry when Thompson improperly attached electrodes to the condemned man's legs. They caught on fire, burned his pants and flesh, and sent clouds of sickening smoke that gagged the witnesses in the courtroom. In 1944, the first jolt failed to kill the condemned man, so Jimmy pulled the switch again and again. 2 hours later, the poor man was still alive and in horrible pain. The sheriff tried to stop the ordeal, but Thompson would have none of it. He ramped up the generator and finished him off with one last charge. In May of 1947, Old Sparky was set up in the main courtroom of the Hinds County Courthouse in Jackson, and a black man convicted of murder was electrocuted. And in July, Jimmy Thompson and his contraption headed to Ford County. Because John Wilbanks had heard the same question so often and had so often given the same honest answer, there was little doubt that the execution was about to take place. There was nothing to stop it, save for a clemency petition Wilbanks filed with the governor without informing his client. Clemency was the sole province of the governor, and the chances of receiving it were slim. When John filed it, he included a letter to the governor explaining that he was doing so only to cover all legal bases. Other than that, as John repeatedly explained, there was nothing to stop the execution. No pending appeals, no last-minute legal maneuverings. Nothing. Clanton celebrated July 4th with its annual parade through downtown, with dozens of uniformed veterans marching and passing out candy to the children. The courthouse lawn was covered with barbecue grills and ice cream stands. A band played in a gazebo. Since it was an election year, candidates took turns at the microphone and made their promises. The celebration, though, was somewhat muted as the townsfolk talked of nothing but the execution. And, as John Wilbanks noted from the balcony of his office, the crowd was definitely smaller than usual. On Tuesday, July 8th, Jimmy Thompson arrived in his silver truck and parked it beside the courthouse. He unloaded it and encouraged all who were curious to have a look. As always, he allowed a few kids to sit in the electric chair and pose for photographs. Reporters were already gathering, and Jimmy regaled them with stories of his great experiences around the state. He walked them through the procedure, explaining in minute detail how the generator remained in the truck and the 2,000-volt current would run approximately 300 feet along the sidewalk and into the courthouse, up the stairs, and into the courtroom where old Sparky was already in place near the jury box. Joel and Stella arrived by train late on Tuesday night and were met at the station by Florrie. They hustled away, ignoring everyone, and went to her pink cottage, where Marietta had dinner waiting. It was a somber evening with little conversation. What could be said? They were sleepwalking into a nightmare as reality slowly settled in. Early Wednesday morning, Nix Gridley stopped by the courthouse and was not surprised to find a small crowd of gawkers staring at old Sparky. Jimmy Thompson, a weasel the sheriff was already tired of, was holding forth on the amazing capabilities of his machine, and after a few minutes, Nix left and walked to the jail. He rounded up Roy Lester, and using a side door, they walked out with Pete Banning and quickly left in Gridley's patrol car. Pete sat in the rear seat without handcuffs and said virtually nothing as they raced south on the Natchez Trace Parkway. In the town of Kosciuszko, they sat in the car as Roy bought biscuits and coffee from a diner. They ate in silence as the miles flew by. The director of the Mississippi State Hospital at Whitfield was waiting at the front gate. Nix followed him through the grounds and to Building 41, where Liza Banning had spent the last 14 months. Two doctors were waiting. Stiff introductions were made, and Pete followed them to an office where they closed the door. Dr. Hilsebeck did the talking.
"Your wife is not doing well, Mr. Banning, sorry to say. And this will only make matters worse. She is in complete withdrawal and speaks to no one."
"I had to come," Pete said. "There was no other way."
"I understand. You will be surprised by her appearance, and don't expect much in the way of a response."
"How much does she know?"
"We've told her everything. She was showing some improvement until she was informed of the murder several months ago. That caused a dramatic setback, and her condition has only deteriorated. 2 weeks ago, after I spoke with the sheriff, when it became apparent that the execution was inevitable, we tried to break it to her gently. That has caused a complete withdrawal. She eats almost nothing and hasn't spoken a word since then. Frankly, if the execution takes place, we have no idea of the impact. Obviously, we are deeply concerned."
"I'd like to see her."
"Very well."
Pete followed them down the hall and up one flight of stairs. A nurse was waiting beside an unmarked door. Hilsebeck nodded at Pete, who opened the door and stepped inside. The nurse and the doctor waited in the hall. The room was lit by only a small dim ceiling light. There was no window. A door was opened to a tiny bathroom. On a narrow wood-framed bed, Liza Banning was propped up by pillows and awake, waiting. She wore a faded gray gown and was tucked in by sheets. Pete carefully walked to the bed and sat by her feet. She watched him closely, as if afraid, and said nothing. She was almost 40, but looked much older, with graying hair, gaunt cheeks, wrinkles, pale skin, and hollow eyes. The room was dark, quiet, motionless. Pete finally said, "Liza, I've come to say goodbye." In a voice that was surprisingly firm, she replied,
"I want to see my children."
"They'll be here in a day or so, after I'm gone. I promise."
She closed her eyes and exhaled, as if relieved. Minutes passed, and Pete began gently rubbing her leg through the sheets. She did not respond. The children will be fine, Liza. I promise. They're strong and they'll survive us. Tears began running down her cheeks, then dripping off her chin. She did not reach to wipe them, nor did he. Minutes passed, and the tears continued. She whispered,
"Do you love me, Pete?"
"I do. I always have, and I've never stopped."
"Can you forgive me?"
Pete looked at the floor and stared blankly for a long time. He cleared his throat and said,
"I cannot lie. I've tried many times, Liza, but no, I cannot forgive you."
"Please, Pete, please say you'll forgive me before you go."
"I'm sorry. I love you, and I'll go to my grave loving you."
"Just like in the old days?"
"Just like in the old days."
"What happened to those days, Pete? Why can't we be together again with the kids?"
"You know the answer, Liza. Too much has happened. I'm sorry."
"I'm sorry too, Pete."
She started sobbing, and he moved closer and gently embraced her. She was frail and brittle, and for a second he flashed back to the skeletons he was forced to bury on Bataan, once healthy soldiers, starved to death, and weighing less than 100 pounds. He closed his eyes and pushed those thoughts away, and somehow managed to remember her body back in the glory days when he couldn't keep his hands off her. He longed for those days, for the not-too-distant past, when they lived in a state of near-constant arousal and never missed an opportunity. He finally broke down and cried too. The Last Supper was cooked by Nineveh, and it was Pete's favorite. Fried pork chops, whipped potatoes and gravy, and boiled okra. He arrived after dark with the sheriff and Roy, who sat on the porch and rocked in wicker chairs as they waited. Nineveh served the family in the dining room, then left the house in tears. Amos walked her home after saying his goodbyes. Pete carried the conversation primarily because no one else had much to say. What were they supposed to say at that awful moment? Flory couldn't eat, and Joel and Stella had no appetites. Pete, though, was hungry and carved his pork chops as he described his visit to Whitfield.
"I told your mom that you would see her on Friday, if that's what you want."
"That should be a pleasant little gathering," Joel said. "We bury you Friday morning, then race off to the nut house to see Mom."
"She needs to see you," Pete said, chewing.
"We've tried once before," Stella said. She had not lifted a fork. "But you intervened. Why?"
"Well, we're not going to argue over our last meal. Now, are we, Stella?"
"Of course not. We're Bannings, and we don't discuss anything. We're expected to keep a stiff upper lip and just plow on, as if everything will be okay. All secrets will be buried. Life will eventually return to normal, and no one will ever know why you've put us in this horrible position. All anger is to be suppressed, all questions ignored. We're Bannings, the toughest of all."
Her voice cracked, and she wiped her face. Pete ignored her and said,
"I've met with John Wilbanks, and everything is in order. Buford has the crops under control, and he'll meet with Flory to make sure the farm runs smoothly. The land is in your names now, and it will stay in the family. The income will be split each year, and you'll get checks by Christmas."
Joel put down his fork and said, "So, life just goes on, right, Dad? The state kills you tomorrow. We bury you the next day. Then we leave and go back to our own little worlds as if nothing has changed."
"Everybody dies at some point, Joel.
My father did not see 50, nor did his father. Bannings don't live long.
Now that's comforting, Flory said.
Male Bannings, I should say. The women folk tend to live longer.
Stella said, could we talk about something other than dying?
Joel said, oh, sure, sis. The weather, the crops, the cardinals. What's on your mind at this terrible hour?
I don't know, she said as she touched her napkin to her eyes. I can't believe this. I can't believe we're sitting here trying to eat when this is the last time we'll ever see you.
You have to be strong, Stella, Pete said.
I'm tired of being strong, or pretending to be. I can't believe this is happening to our family. Why have you done this?
There was a long gap as both women wiped their eyes. Joel took a bite of potatoes and swallowed without chewing.
So, I guess you plan to take your secrets to your grave, right, Dad? Even now, at the last hour, you can't tell us why you killed Dexter Bell. So we are destined to spend the rest of our lives wondering why. Is that where we are?
I've told you. I'll not discuss it.
Of course not.
You owe us an explanation, Stella said.
I don't owe you a damn thing, Pete snapped angrily, then took a deep breath and said, I'm sorry, but I'll not discuss it.
I have a question, Joel said calmly, and since this will be my last chance to ask it, and it's something I'll be curious about for the rest of my life, I'm going to ask. You saw a lot of terrible things in the war, a lot of suffering and dying, and you yourself killed a lot of men in battle. When a soldier sees that much death, does it make you callous? Does it make life and living somewhat cheaper? Do you reach a point where you think that death is not that big of a deal? I'm not being critical, Dad. I'm just curious.
Pete took a bite of a pork chop and chewed it as he considered the question.
I suppose so. I reached a point where I knew I was going to die. And when that happens in battle, a soldier accepts his fate and fights even harder. I lost a lot of friends. I even buried some of them. So I stopped making friends. Then I didn't die. I survived. And because of what I went through, it made life even more precious. But I realized that dying is a part of living. Everybody reaches the end, some sooner than others. Does that answer your question?
Not really. I guess there are no answers. I thought we weren't talking about dying, Flory said. This is surreal, Stella said.
Life is never cheap, Pete continued. Every day is a gift. And don't forget that.
What about Dexter Bell's life? Joel asked.
He deserved to die, Joel. You'll never understand it, and I suppose you'll learn one day that life is filled with things we can never understand. There's no guarantee that you are allowed to live with the full knowledge of everything. There are a lot of mysteries out there. Accept them and move on.
Pete wiped his mouth and shoved his plate away.
I have a question, Stella said. You'll be remembered for a long time around here, and not for the right reasons. In fact, your death will probably become a legend. My question is this. How do you want us to remember you?
Pete smiled and replied, as a good man who created two beautiful children. Let the world say what it wants. It cannot say anything bad about the two of you. I'll die a proud man because of you and your brother.
Stella covered her face with her napkin and began sobbing. Pete slowly stood and said,
I need to be going.
The sheriff's had a long day.
Joel stood with tears running down his cheeks and hugged his father, who said,